but rather what we're going to do is start Prakim Yud Gimel Yud Dalet. And as I said, that starts a whole new unit. So your first unit was the era of Uzziyahu. Your second unit was the era of Ahaz, and trying to convince Ahaz not to join the Assyrians and not to join the Syro-Ephraimite alliance, offering him miracles as signs, assuring him the Assyrians will fall, the Northern Alliance will fall, there will be a divine rescue, there will be a messianic time. All of that you can now forget. Just kidding. But all of that is now, we have that. You can put that away in the bag. We did that. Now we start a brand new segment. If you look on your sheet after source number 2, I brought you an outline of chapters 13 to 23. So chapters 13 into chapter 14 are going to address Babel and foresee the fall of Babylon. I have to talk more about that in a minute. We're going to come back to that. There's a lot to say about that. But that's what you're going to see predicted in chapters 13 and 14. Then you get a little bit at the end of chapter 14 about the Plishtim, the Philistines, how they will be punished. Then you move on to Moab. Then the Syro-Ephraimite alliance of Aram and Yisrael. And the news reaches Ethiopia of their fall. Then you move into Egypt and Ethiopia suffering a punishment. All of these punishments are for things they've done to us. Then you get a nation identified as Arabia, Arav. And then you get Yerushalayim, Judea, being punished as well for their own wrongdoing. And then you get Shevna. Shevna is unique. Shevna is a person, not a nation. The Gemara sees him as a rival to Chizkiyahu. We'll learn more about him, obviously, when we get to chapter 23. But it's really funny to see, maybe not funny to him, but it's funny to see where you're talking to all of these nations and saying, you did this, and therefore you collectively are going to be punished, and so on. You go down the list, and then you pick out one guy by the name of Shevna, who's going to be targeted for this. It really stands out. Before the section concludes with Tzor, Tyre, right up in what is today Lebanon. How many targets are there here for divine punishment?
Do you want us to count them?
Well, that's how you get the number usually. Ten. Egypt and Ethiopia, right, are lumped together in 19 and 20. So you end up with 10. 10 always being a number signifying something complete, right? It's always the unit number. You know, Aseres Hadibros being one example of many, many that you could bring. 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. 10 is often, even when the text does not bother to identify it for you, it just assumes you realize. It signifies something that is complete. So what you're seeing here is a vision of the complete punishment of the wicked of the region. But that forces us to ask a question. Who is Yeshaya's audience?
The students.
His audience, you say, are his students. Could be. Could be. I mean, clearly, the audience is not the set of nations he's addressing here. We have Nevi'im who address the nations, so to speak. Yirmiyahu does it in chapters 46 to 51. Yechezkel does it in chapters 26 to 32. Amos has his famous run, right, of this one for their sins, this one for their sins, this one's for their sins, and so on. But it's rare to have a case that's a Yonah case, where you actually have the Navi go to them and present a message. You know, Ovadia would be another example of somebody who addresses a nation, but again, he's not actually going to their land and having a conversation. It's a message to us. It's referencing them to make a point, and maybe that's his students in particular. And I'm going to come back to Ora's point about his students, because it's going to be relevant when we talk about Babel in particular. I'm not there yet. But what is the point of telling the Jews, I'm going to punish Babel, I'm going to punish the Plishtim, I'm going to punish Moab, and so on down the list? What is the message to us? What are we supposed to learn from this?
Be afraid.
What do you mean?
Well, behave yourself, because I'm going to punish those who don't.
Interesting. So you're saying that all the warnings that we get of God punishing us are insufficient. We need a message of God punishing them.
This is pretty big. This isn't like a little hoo-ha.
No.
These are 10 or 9 distinct groups in one person.
Yes.
That's a large universe. It's also giving them hope that things are going to be okay at the end, despite all.
Right. It's worth noting that throughout this section, first of all, note, this section is not monolithic. Meaning, you're not going to see 10 identical messages just trade in the name of the nation you're talking to. You're going to see color in this. There will be variation in what is said and how it's said and what Yeshaya's own response to it is. So there will be, you know, it's not just, you know, fill in the blank, name your enemy here type stuff. But interspersed within it, you will also see messages of consolation to us. I'm going to take care of you as I zap them. So there is much more of the positive feel for the Jews. And in fact, the way that Professor Amos Chacham, the Dan Mikra, looks at it, is he says the message is that God is going to punish them for what they've done. Just like you get zapped, it's not just you, they also get it. So take a look at source number 3. Equal opportunity, you betcha. And then some. If you take a look at source number 3 from Amos Chacham's introduction to the Dan Mikra edition of Yeshaya, he says, our predecessors already addressed the question of the intent of the prophecies upon the nations in the book of Yeshaya. Many commentators take the view that the prophecies upon the nations were not written and certainly were not recorded for future generations for the use of those nations, but for the use of Israel. It's not really like we expect a Plishtim to learn something from Yeshaya Perek Yedalet. That's not what's going on. It's for us. The simple explanation of the text is that Hashem supervises, rewarding and punishing the wicked in all nations. And Hashem's supervision designated Assyria as the rod of divine rage upon all the wicked nations, not only upon Israel. Everything that happens is God punishing for what they have done. Yes?
The only thing I take exception with is saying not recorded for future generations. We all know that writing by great people is for future generations.
No, what he's saying is that it is recorded for future generations, but not for the use of those nations.
Say again?
It is recorded for future generations, but not for those nations' sake. Rather, read the sentence again. They were not written and certainly were not recorded for future generations for the use of those nations.
Okay.
Rather, for the use of Israel. It's hard to translate his Hebrew because he writes Baruch Sha'amar. You know, it's like it's a very long, 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 long run-on sentence, and you just sort of have to artificially decide where you're going to stop him, because he didn't need to breathe. But that makes it harder to do a linear translation of it that's going to come across clearly. But he's saying it absolutely is recorded for future generations, just not their generations, our generations. That's the idea.
But
welcome back.
Up until now, Isaiah has always been about destruction followed by hope.
Yes.
Is that the same message?
Nope.
No.
No hope there for them. Just
yes.
Us. Sorry.
Okay.
That's not entirely true. I shouldn't say that. There will be hope for some of them. But not Babel.
Right.
Babel's done. You know what's really remarkable? We're going to get there shortly, so I shouldn't really say this now. I should save it. But I was so struck by this because I had never thought about it this way. The Babylonian Empire has two eras, right, that are real empire eras. The first one is in the age of Hammurabi, right? So you're talking like 18th century before the Common Era. Then you have this lull where they're basically a backwater. And then they rise to standing again towards the end of the 7th century before the Common Era. It's, I think, the year 612 BCE that they defeat the Assyrians. Okay? The year 539 BCE is when Cyrus the Persian, along with the Medes, destroys the Babylonian Empire. So Nebuchadnezzar's great Babylonian Empire that we think of as having been so powerful, right? The Gemara says Nebuchadnezzar reigns over the entire world, right? Some debate, not the point right now. That whole period of their power really is the year 612. I'm working with a historian's numbers. 612 to 539. Right? In other words, a period of 73 years. That's it. Isn't that striking? Like, I always thought of the Babylonian Empire as this great empire. I mean, look, that's not a small period of time. But on the other hand, I think of the empires of old, I just assume centuries of power. Whether it's true or not. The
Soviet Union. 70 years.
True.
One lifetime.
So, yes.
So it kind of answers my question. How many people hearing this would see this happen? But there could have been people that saw this. That will see this happen.
That will see what happen. That will see the Babylonians? Well, absolutely not. And this is a problem that leads to my challenge to Professor Chacham's point. So thank you for the segue. The problem that I have, again, he reads the message to the nations as a message to us saying, don't worry, just like I'm punishing you when you do things wrong, I'm also punishing them when they do things wrong. The problem is, how many Jews at the time that Yeshaya issues this prophecy ever met a Babylonian? Ever knew anything about the Babylonians being a threat? The Babylonians aren't going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash for generations. They aren't even on the scene. They certainly haven't done anything to the Assyrians. The Assyrians haven't even come through the area yet. So this is, you know, one of those cases. We're going to talk about why he's talking about the Babylonians in a bit. I'm going to come back to that. And that's where I was planning to discuss the chronology. But the my point right now, though, is Yeshaya's audience, assuming that, and this isn't necessarily a safe assumption, but assuming that this is being publicized and promoted where it appears in the book, they're not getting any reassurance from a story about punishing Babylonians who they don't know anything about. What did they do wrong? I don't know. You know, it's an odd thing. I found a great article, though, by a fellow by the name of Erel Siegel. And it's called Nevuot Puranut al Hagoyim. I brought a piece of it in number 4. It's not a long article. In which he offered two other explanations for the goal of this section. Take a look, please, at number 4. He says his first answer is an approach not just to Yeshaya's message, but to all the times in Tanakh when our prophets say God is going to punish the nations as a whole. His second answer is Yeshaya specific. Yeah.
Starting from Egypt.
I understand, though. There's a practical message. There's a practical message, right? He's saying, I'm going to send the Jews down. They're going to suffer. But don't worry. The justice will be done to those who harm them.
Isn't that what he's saying here, too? That you're going to be invaded by these people. They're going to invade you.
But here he doesn't list their sins.
He doesn't.
Nope. And in some of them, as we go through it, we're going to be left wondering, what did they do wrong? Like Tyre, at the end of the list. We're going to have to work to figure out what Tyre did to anger God. So, we'll find something. Don't worry. Everyone's got dirt. But a dossier is going to be hard to find. So, if you take a look at source number 4, his first general approach for all biblical prophecies upon non-Jewish nations to the question, and he says it's based on a lecture by someone named Nitzan, I don't know who that was, is that the prophecies come to teach us that God rules all of the nations and supervises them. At the time, the popular belief was that each nation has a national God who only supervises that nation. To distance that thought, God gave the prophets prophecies upon all of the nations known to the Jews. And so God taught the Jews that he supervises the entire world, not only them. God is not provincial. God deals with everyone. And that's an overall message when your Navi tells you that God is going to be active in all of these lands. Fine, but I really like his latter answer. In the days of Yeshaya, Israel was divided into parties, each party wishing to execute a pact with one of the regional nations. We talked about this. Some wanted the Syro-Ephraimite alliance, some wanted the Assyrians. The goal of these Masa'ot means these prophecies to the nations, many of which begin with the word Masa, Mem Sin Aleph, as we'll see. The goal of these Masa'ot was to demonstrate to all of the parties that they were in error. All of the nations will fall. And there is no reason to execute a pact with them, but only to rely upon God.
Should we send a copy of that to the election campaign in Israel?
Go for it. What he suggests is that this fits in really well to the themes of Yeshaya. That's why I like the answer. because so much of what we just saw was Yeshaya trying to convince Ahaz and Judea of his time not to enter the alliances. And so now God is saying, all these nations around you that you think are going to be your friends and you think will be the source of your support can't help you. They're all these zanvot ha'udim ha'ashenim, the way that he described the Arameans and the Northern Kingdom. They're nothing. They're smoking brands left over from what had once been on fire. So that would be a good way to read this. And that leads me to my second question about this section. Now we know who his audience is. His audience is the Jews. And he's trying to convey to them either, I'm going to punish them also, not just you, or I'm not provincial, I deal with everybody, or to discourage us from looking to them for alliances. Now we have to ask, how does this fit into the book as a whole? This section here, you could take this out of Sefer Yeshaya and not notice. Not just because Yeshaya has, you know, so many chapters, but because you don't really need it for the book. You know, traditional commentators didn't really ask questions like this of why is this here? It's here because it's here. Right? The most you get is somebody asking, how did the last sentence in the previous chapter lead into the opening sentence in this chapter? So, for example, look at Ibn Ezra in source number 5. Perfect example. Ibn Ezra says, his kir mapolet bavel achar mapolet Ashur. He mentioned the fall of Babylon, chapter 13. After the fall of Ashur, chapters 11 and 12, why? Ki Babel hishchit Ashur, because Babylon destroyed Assyria. So we talked about the fall of Babylon, now of Assyria, now we'll talk about the fall of Babylon. He doesn't look at it as, here's a block of chapters, and I need to explain what they're doing here. It's here, and it flows. And once we mention Babylon, then we can mention the next one and the next one. It's rare that you get, Rav Bach sometimes will do it, Abarbanel will sometimes do it, but it's not so common to see that sort of observation. But again, if I take Siegel's second approach, I understand how it fits the book. I understand how it belongs here in the book. It's, again, all about pursuing alliances with the nations around you. Last point of introduction to this section. How and when are these prophecies about the nations communicated to the people? The only date that we get in this whole section is in chapter 14, sentence 28. If you take a look on page 979, chapter 14, sentence 28. This is, remember I said to you that the end of chapter 14 has a little vision for the Plishtim, for the Philistines. It begins, Bishnas Mos HaMelech Ahaz. In the year of the death of King Ahaz. So, that's the only time we are told when one of these prophecies is issued. And I could read that and say, well, that means that one is then and the other ones are not. I don't know. It's not at all clear what that's doing. And so, I don't know at what point this vision is presented, but I do have a problem if I'm going to claim that it's during Ahaz's time. And this goes back to the chronology that I outlined for you a little while ago. Babel at this point, again, is a backwater. This Neo-Babylonian Empire, as they call it, that's going to be responsible for the fall of the Assyrians, is only going to begin its rise, according to historians, in the year 626 before the Common Era. That's when they date the rise of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. So, when are the Jews hearing this? So you could say, well, Yeshaya is filled with future referencing messages, like the Cyrus ones that we've mentioned before. And if the point was really just to say, don't make alliances with the people around you, so I don't really need to know so much about what Babel did wrong. But Amos Chacham, in source number 6, has an idea. The truth is, the comment that I brought you in number 6, I cut and pasted I used this source in a different shear, and I put it here. It's not a comment on our chapters, but he makes the same comment, just longer, on our chapters. And what he says is, he's talking in this quote about the Cyrus prophecies. Logically, Yeshaya did not publicize the name of Cyrus in the prophecies he related public. Rather, he gave this to his limudav, his students, in the prophecies that he sealed for a later generation. And these prophecies were publicized in the generation of Cyrus by the students of his school. When Yeshayah said something that made no sense to people of his day, he wasn't talking to people of his day. We know, we've already seen a reference to it, they referenced it here, chapter 8, sentence 16, Tzor tu udach atom tarab limudai. We saw already that Yeshayah has been told by God for some of his prophecies. Seal it up. It's not for the audience right now. Give it to your limudim. Give it to your students. Limudim equals talmidim. Give it to your students, and eventually it will be for promotion. But it's not for the nation right now. So it's entirely possible that Yeshayah receives the messages now, but the nation doesn't hear it until later. You follow? Which would explain an awful lot, because otherwise I have no idea what they would do with a message about the fall of Babylon. It just doesn't have any... There's no reason for it.
So Yeshayah received them, wrote it down, essentially, gave it to somebody to keep, but was not a rating.
Correct.
Wow.
Or rating. Yeah.
Wait a
minute. Well, it's not so strange. Meaning, so much of Judaism was passed down in teacher-to-student mode and without publication for so long that, you know, that in of itself is not strange. What makes it hard is that the lines are not drawn in the text. You know, we're supposed to figure out, chapters 13 to 23 were part of the private section. Chapter 44, 45 is part of the private section. Chapter 1, on the other hand, he walked through the streets ranting and raving. Even within this section, we're going to see... Ranting and raving is not a term that I should have used. Sorry, that was not the right word. We're going to see, within this section, descriptions of some strange behavior for Yeshayah. And it's going to sound like it's public. So we may have to revisit this thought and its reference here. This is not going to be so clear cut.
So these students who received the scrolls, or these senior students who received the scrolls, knew when to reveal them.
Yes.
Or to pass them on to a generation.
Yes. They are told, hold on to it.
Until
who knows, but at some point it makes it into the book.
Until God speaks to you, or until somebody who God has spoken to, another prophet.
Till a date marked on the calendar. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's an overall introduction to this section. But let's now talk about this particular prophecy to and about Babel. So I gave you an outline in source number 7 on your sheet. There's a one-sentence introduction to it, as we'll see. Then you spend 21 psukim talking about Babylon being in ruins. God summons warriors to punish Babel. They should be afraid. They should be very afraid. The destruction is described in these very dire terms. The invasion by Madai, Media, and Babylon in ruins. Then you get a couple of sentences of the Jews will be saved from harm through the fall of Babylon. Then you get more about the fall of Babylon, including the mocking of Babel. And then, at the end of this, a summary of the fall of Babylon before we move on to the Plishtim. That's your basic outline of what's going to happen here. It is devastating. The opening of this prophecy, though, is fascinating. Take a look, please. You're now back on page 975. The opening sentence. Chapter 13, sentence 1. We're right?
I'm a little confused by it.
Yeah. It exists, but it's a nothing empire. It's not an empire. It's a nothing nation.
All this time talking about what's going to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
We should really have like a timeline map with what's happening.
It's true. This can be confusing. Yeah.
Now, and then we go down, and this is for then.
Yeah, it would be good if the book came with that.
I know. The
problem is that every time we start talking about time, certain people get a headache. Do you remember how many people were when we spent that time? Well, forget Ezra and Nehemiah, but even within Yeshayah, when we tried to figure out when chapter 1 took place and when chapter 6 took place. Okay, so once we finish it, that will be your term project. There you go. You think I should do all the work? So Masa Babel, the Masa of Babel. Masada translate here entirely inadequately as a prophecy. Ha! The Masa Bavel, a prophecy upon Babylon.
It's called, it says
burden. Burden. Okay, the current edition has burden. Now we're talking. Anyone else? You have JPS, right, Debbie?
Masa prophecy.
They do prophecy. I turn up my news.
Campaign or something.
Well, that's the question. It can't be campaign because it's spelled differently. You're thinking of Mem Samach Ayin. This is Mem Sin Aleph. But what is it?
It's a good question.
Right, so I don't tend to think that was the issue. Not with his command of language. The Asher Chaza Yeshayahu Ben Amotz, which Yeshayah Ben Amotz prophesied. So first of all, the word Masa is a fascinating word. And Lashemea.
Is
the Ivrit, sure.
Louder.
Oh, Merim et hakol. Lisa kolo. To raise his voice. That's an interesting one. Could be. But when you look in Tanakh, and I gave you some references in source number 8 at examples of this, at the use of the word masa to introduce a prophecy, it's pretty much always a vision of punishment. A vision of punishment. So you see it in Nahum, his Masa Ninveh, his vision about the fall of the Assyrians. You see it in Habakkuk. You see it in Malachi. You see it in Mishlei, is his mother's rebuke. The king's mother, Bathsheba, rebuking Shlomo. Asher Yisarto Imo. It's always a harsh message. So that they tend to take Masa to mean a burden, which is the way that the Koran translated. They tend to take it as a burden. You have other things you can do. You could. There are other ways, but usually it's taken as a weight, a burden. So the Vilna Gaon, commenting on Treyasar, so on Nahum and Habakkuk, says that it's the weight of divine judgment. On the other hand, I brought you the Targum Yonatan in source number 9. Matel kas di levat. Matel is a burden, right? Like litol, to pick something up. Matel is a burden. Kas di levat. Kas is a kos, is a cup. Levat is a curse. Right? This is something I like to note, although not everybody agrees with me on this, but that's okay. That Lot, the name Lot itself, as in Sarah's brother, Abram's brother-in-law, the one who does what he does in Sodom and thereafter, means curse. The other way to take it is to mean something that is in secret or in hiding. That's the other way you could take the word. But Levad is a curse. La'ashka yat Babel, to give to Babel to drink. Did not that Yeshayah bar Amotz, which Yeshayah son of Amotz prophesied. So it is the burden of the accursed cup, meaning the weight is not judgment, it's the weight of punishment. That's why it's called a Masa. It is a vision of punishment.
What's the other word that are used for prophecy?
Chazon is sort of the gold standard, certainly within Yeshayah. Sorry? Nivuah you sometimes have. You have Davar. Right, there are lots of other words that you can use. There's something else that's odd here. What else is odd in this sentence? Yeah.
I thought we're in chapter 13. We already know Yeshayahu is the son of
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you name Yeshayahu ben Amotz? Pleased to meet you. We met you in the opening sentence of the opening chapter. Granted that chapter didn't necessarily always didn't come at the beginning of his prophecies. But why are you giving us a full Yeshayahu ben Amotz? So three answers.
Is there a certain formality?
Right, so the Da'at Mikra, Professor Chacham, offers two explanations. His first explanation is that it's the start of a unit. That's one. Second idea that he offers is to stress that Yeshayah called it far in advance. It's not a... don't think that somebody who's contemporary with the fall of Babylon said this. This is Yeshayah ben Amotz speaking. So that's the second approach. Rabbi Shlomo Pines offers another approach. He says the later generations are not necessarily going to believe that consolation is coming. They're going to think, you know, we've been suffering for so long, it can't possibly be. We're going to suffer. We continue to suffer. And so the idea is that when you credit it to Yeshaya, the prophet of old, someone who people will respect more naturally because he doesn't live in their day, so that will give it more standing in their time. It's not just anybody, it's Yeshaya talking. Could be, but yeah, I agree. It's certainly remarkable. And then we begin this unit of punishments with Bavel in particular. So you could take Ibn Ezra's view. It's logical because after the destruction of Ashur, then comes the destruction of Bavel. On your graph, Bria, you can include that. As a matter of fact, the demolition of Ashur will affect the prophecy itself in chapter 14. But it also could be that Bavel comes first as a matter of pride of place, in the sense that they're the destroyers of the Beit HaMikdash. Not yet, mind you, but they will be. And so they're the first ones that God is listing here of those he's going to punish. It's going to be this nation that destroyed his temple. That could be why they go first.
And also to distinguish between the prophet of Irmiyahu and Yeshayahu.
Meaning?
The difference. Because Irmiyahu already has a prophecy about Bavel.
Oh, you mean why it mentions Yeshayahu's name?
Okay.
Right, so it distinguishes between him and others who spoke about this. That's good. Good. So we move into the section that describes Bavel in ruins. So we're not going to be going through everything, you know, sentence by sentence, word by word. But the overall theme within this section is it's not only the fall of a nation, it's a divine remaking of the world. That's the way that we look at the fall of Bavel. And it's personal for God. This is really striking. Take a look at chapter 13, sentences 3 to 5 in particular. It's again, I'm picking and choosing what we're going to look at here just because otherwise we'll never go through it. But look at start with sentence 3. I'm going to do a translation on the fly here as we look at it. I have commanded Mikudashai, which either means those dedicated to me or my holy ones. I'm going to come back to that word. I have also called my warriors in my anger, Alizei Gaavati, those who rejoice in my, they say, grandeur? Okay, fine. The sound of the masses in the mountains, it sounds like a great nation coming, which is something we actually find elsewhere in Tanakh, the being fooled into a great, you know, and not recognizing there's a great nation coming. Kol Sha'on Mamlachos Goyim Ne'esafim, the sound of these empires gathering. God is the Mefaked Tzva Milchama, God is leading the charge. He is the officer. They come from afar. God and the tools of his anger to destroy the land. So what strikes me here, in particular, is seen in sentence 3, the first person. It's not really first person, that's the wrong term for it. But it's the possessive, that's what I want to say. It's the single possessive. They are giborai, they're my warriors, God says. In the same language that God uses to describe us usually. Right? We are ami, we're God's nation. Those who are going to come destroy Babylon are God's warriors. They are mikudashai. They're the ones dedicated to me, and God is their commander. And here I want to highlight that word mikudashai. Such a fascinating word. Right? How did they translate mikudashai here? My dedicated ones. It doesn't mean dedicated the way we usually use the word as an adjective to describe how someone is committed to something. That's not what it means. You can be makdish something, meaning to make it holy. You can be makdish something, meaning you dedicate it for a particular role. Not necessarily a holy role, distinct from a holy roller. Not necessarily a sacred role, but a role. They have a role to play. Take a look, please, at source number 10, and you will see the Gemara deal with this. The Gemara is bothered by the word mikudashai. That you are willing to call the destroyers of Bavel mikudashai. Keep in mind, who's destroying Bavel? Right? Purim is tomorrow night. Parasu Madai. There they be the destroyers of Bavel. Do you want to call them holy? I mean, Cyrus is going to be special to God. We've already talked about that somewhat. But
consecrated, what about?
Well, that, yes, dedicated. Well, once you say consecrated, it sounds like there's an element of holiness beyond simple dedication. So take a look at source number 10, because that's exactly the fight that Gemara is having. Amar Rabban Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel said, Bishlosha dvarim ohev ani et haparsiyim. There are three aspects of the Persians that I love about them. I love the Persians for three things. Number one, hein snu'in v'achilatan. They're private when they eat. They don't eat maybe out in public, or maybe they eat with good manners. Snu'in v'beit hakisei. They are private in the washroom. Utsnu'in v'davar acher. They're private in the bedroom. Anit siviti l'mekudashai. And he said, look, God calls the Persians his sanctified ones. There's a sense of holiness about them. But then Rabbi Yosef gets up and says, no. Tani Rabbi Yosef taught, Elu aparsiyim mekudashai, refers to the Persians, hamekudashin umezumanin legehinom. They are dedicated and prepared for hell. Mekudashai doesn't mean sanctified, it just means they are dedicated for a particular end. It's exactly this problem. How can you call them holy even if they're doing God's work? Janine and then Paul.
Just when the description of the Persians that we're going to read about in 2 days is they didn't eat privately in their bed. I mean,
yeah, this is a good point.
The whole thing is
Rabbi Gamliel's Persians were perhaps a little more domesticated than Ahasuerus's Persians. This is a fair point, Paul.
So, if the purpose and the theme is that God is the ruler of the whole world, all of the nations, then He can dedicate whoever He wants to do His holy work.
Yes.
So he can confer on them a certain, you don't want to say holiness, certainly holy task,
right,
of punishing the Jews.
Right.
And then they'll be punished in their turn.
Yes.
But the point is that, yes, they are holy while they're doing God's work because He assigned them that task.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But using the term holy as opposed to the term that they are assigned a task is loaded.
Yeah.
And that's what Rabbi Yosef is uncomfortable with. So the idea here, though, is the warriors who will destroy Babel, they belong to God. They are mine with a capital M. I think that's fascinating. Take a look now at Psukim Vav Techet, 10 to 6 to 8, because you get Yeshaya with his metaphors. He says, sing to God, the day of God is nigh. Kishod Mishakai Yavo, that's his play on words, right? Shod, and then the name of God, Shaddai. It's wordplay there, that the despoiling at the hands of God is coming. And he says, therefore all hands shall become weak, every heart shall melt, and Nivhalu, the Nivhalu I should say, they will be in shock. They do terrorized here, that's a good word. Tzirim v'chavalim yochezun, they will be gripped with pains. Kayoleda yechilun, they will tremble like a woman giving birth. Ish el re'ehu yismahu, each one will turn to the next in shock. Pnei lahavim pneihem, their faces are on fire. It's describing the fear that the Babylonians feel, right? That's what you're seeing here. But the image is of a woman in labor. Right, that's the image that he uses. The fear of it, the trembling of it, that's the description of a woman in labor. And it's very interesting because you can really read this on two levels. What are the two levels here? What are the two levels that you can use here to access this this metaphor? What are the two aspects of a woman in childbirth?
Pain.
And birth, right? It's pain, but it's also birth. You see both levels here. On the one hand, you have the fear of Babel, and Yeshaya is so pitch perfect in his description of panic. Because look at sentence 7. I haven't seen anyone note this, but it's so clear cut. Sentence 7 is different from sentence 8. What happens in sentence 7?
General, then it's specifically women in 7.
Mm. In sentence 7, all the muscles go limp. The heart melts. The hands release. In sentence 8, all the muscles clench. Right? It's a contraction, is what he's describing.
So So it's a natural response to fear.
Yes.
You're frightened and then you move.
Yes. That's what Yeshaya is doing here. And here especially, did you notice the note? I mean, those who read Trump. Just the musical note in the beginning of sentence 8 on the word Vinevhalu. What is that note? It's a shalshelet, right? If you were reading it in the Chumash, then your trump would sound like this. Vinevhalu. That's what you would be reading. It's this cycle. You know, that's the description of the trembling and the cycle of contraction that they're experiencing. And fascinatingly, there are only three shalshalot, if you will, in all of Navi, in all of the prophets. One, well, we'll get to it in a moment because I'm going to say more about it, but you can see I referenced them in number 11. One is in Ezra and one is in Amos. I'm going to come back to that, but here it's conveying that cycle, the clenching and the releasing. Right, much like the shalshelet that appears when Lot doesn't want to leave Sodom. They grab him and they want him to leave, right? And it's vayit ma'ma. Right? He's hesitating. He doesn't know. Should I go out? Should I go out? Should I go out? Or Yosef, when Potiphar's wife is trying to convince him, and it's vayit ma'ein, again, the shalshelet. Not all shalshelot can be explained that way. There's one on the word vayishchad in Chumash. It's very hard to understand. But in general, it's this kind of a vacillation and oscillation here associated with the fact that they're in such panic. That's one level here. But the second side of it is birth. Because what's the birth that comes with the fall of Babel?
Rebirth of Israel.
The Bayit Sheni, the second temple. Cyrus conquers Babel and that year says, go back and build yourselves a temple. It's the birth of a new world and it's the birth of a Beit HaMikdash, and that fits the Shalshelet as well, because the two references I gave you here in source number 11, we're not going to be able to look at them up, but you can do that later. Extra credit. The pasuk in Amos, the Shalshelet is on God roaring as he punishes the nations. And the one in Ezra is when Cyrus tells Sheshbatzar to bring the vessels of the temple back home. All part of this collapse of the old order, introduction of the Beit HaMikdash, and introduction of the new order. Now, I gave you a link in number 12, because I think it's worth recognizing that when you're dealing with the musical notes, when you're dealing with the trop, there is a meaning side of it, and especially we're going to read Megillat Esther tomorrow night. You can see a lot of that in the notes in Megillat Esther, where the note matches what's being described. But there's also a technical side. The notes help you to read the text, to tell you where to pause and where to put emphasis. And depending on which note it is, it will actually change the meaning of the text based on how you break things up. So I gave you a reference there to a webpage where they talk about why the shalshelet is there from a grammatical standpoint. What it's supposed to be. And why is there. Basically, if I remember correctly, it's a segol without a zarka. For those who know Trump, it's where there should be a segol on the first word of a sentence. But you can't, because the segol always has a zarka before it. So instead it becomes a shalshelet. Again, take a look at the link. You will find more there. But I think we're going to pause with this. There's more, obviously, here to talk about as we go forward. But Babel is in ruins. Please, before next time, if you could make sure to finish reading chapters 13 and 14, that's what I would hope to get through. Next time, Chag Purim Sameach.